Thanks for tuning in to the Music Therapy Research Blog Podcast. I'm Andrew, and Dr. Lagasse will join me for our main talk in a second here. Just to introduce the topic for the day, we're back. That's the big topic, actually. Over the course of our interview, we were reminded that we actually started this project in 2010, had a little bit of a break and some computer issues, and now the blog's back up, but we weren't able to salvage all the podcasts dating back to that time. We do have a couple that are still up, and we're going to try to post a couple more that we've been able to find on hard drives and such, and we'll try to get those online. But also, we want to we're going to do our best to get back to a nice regular setting here. So if you would go to iTunes and hit subscribe on the Music Therapy Research Blog podcast page, we would love that, and we'd love it even more if you really enjoy the podcast and can give us some feedback about it, if you want to rate it on iTunes and all that stuff. So we talk a little bit about what our plans are getting into the getting back into the swing of things here, a little bit of a survey of what's changed since 2010 in our minds in terms of research and the journals and technology and research, some of our own directions, and we'll start establishing some of our guests that we want to bring by. And so there's a lot of different stuff going on today in the podcast, and hope you enjoy it. I'm sure you will, and please be in touch. Thank you very much for listening.
Let's call it not podcast number one, or we should call this podcast number one again, or we should call it 1A, because it's not technically our first podcast.
No, it's not. But it is the first podcast where we are both sitting in the same room.
Right, yeah, as opposed to having to deal with the magic or mystery or madness of Skype and even bringing people in at the same time, and so we can talk to them. But even that, when we were doing Skype interviews, it's neat, and we should, and I'd like to still keep on doing Skype interviews. Not right now, because this is enough technology that's proving very difficult. It's like from the time that we started doing this podcast, when did we start doing this podcast?
It's been a couple years.
3 years ago?
Mm-hmm, I think so.
So from the time we started doing this podcast, GarageBand has completely made it impossible for me to want to do a podcast with you. To the point where we're actually physically in the same building. We have really nice microphones that we can talk into, very expensive equipment, nice looking monitors and everything, and I still don't want to go through the rigmarole of GarageBand. But I'm dedicating myself to it. We must have people that want to hear this, or at least three people that retweeted it when I sent it out
this week. Right.
And we better have a doggone podcast online at some point, otherwise my tweet will be for naught and people will be calling me out.
Very true. Well, I'm excited that the hiatus is over and that we're going to be reestablishing the podcast and for the different things that we'll be able to do with the podcast.
Yeah, especially because now it's September 11th, 2014. We're back into the academic year. We're both at Colorado State now. And we've got an awful lot of students. Now that I'm here, I can see that too. An awful lot of students that are interested in research. So I think we should get them on the podcast because, let's be honest, are they really going to say no if we invite them onto the podcast? Talk about how's your thesis research? How's your senior project research going? Come and talk to us.
Well, not only students from our school, but that's a great idea for getting students from other schools involved and to talk about what's new and fresh, because a lot of times that student research is what's pushing the boundaries, at least initially, mm-hmm. especially in today's environment of research where grants are hard to come by. And more, you'll actually probably see more master's and doctoral work coming out than a lot of grant-funded research in music therapy, unfortunately.
And probably just, you're talking a little bit about the quality of the research, but the quantity of the research is going up too. It really seems like places like CSU, places like, Kansas, Florida State, it seems like there's an awful lot more music therapists that are getting their graduate degrees. You know, we've got our debates in the field right now about master's level entry, but it sure seems like graduate level education generally, is going up. But then there's this other aspect of, you know, not to say that graduate level education necessarily has to tie into research and has to tie into a thesis. Certainly people can just do senior projects or master's projects and things like that. So there must be something else driving it. But I do feel like there is a need for more people to understand research. So hopefully this podcast can make it a little bit more palatable.
I agree. And what I'm seeing in the research base out there is that a lot of people are publishing about music therapy or music type of research that has to do with the humanities, so music in the brain or so forth, that are not music therapists. So I actually see more and more research coming out from music neuroscientists or people who are nurses or psychologists, etc., who are just interested in how music affects emotion, motor, or other skills in individuals. But the number of research projects coming out by music therapists, I don't know that there's a huge increase. You might disagree with me, but I think...
No, I don't disagree at all. As a matter of fact, it made me think of... Now, we had Dr. Sherry Raab on the podcast once. Mm-hmm. Did we have Deb Burns?
Yes, we had Deb Burns at a conference.
Otherwise, we'd have to put the back. Yeah, she was just talking about a poster. We should get her on for a substantive interview. Yeah. We should put out the back call to Deb.
Well, and that's one of the things I hope that we do with the podcast moving forward is continue to interview researchers from different methodologies who are doing different types of research so that we can bring to the listeners kind of an overview of what's current and what's happening now. As you know, with dissemination, there's oftentimes a long time between when someone's actually doing a study and when it's coming out in the journals, although our journals have taken a great step to decrease that time with doing advanced access. So if you go on to Oxford now and look at the Journal of Music Therapy, you can see articles that will be published in the actual print journal later, but are now available online. And that really helps to cut down that time in between when someone did research and when it gets published.
Right. Two things with that. So the first thing was when I was thinking about Drs. Raab and Burns, which would be a great title for a sitcom if they wanted to put one together. I'm sure they've talked about it at conferences before. Because they came out, I think it was 2011, they came out with the article because they saw the need for explaining how to report, guidelines for reporting on music-based interventions. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was Raab, Burns, Carpenter. In 2011, I think that's a highly cited piece. It was in Journal of Health Information. I probably should have looked that up.
I think we can post a link to it, actually. I think it's open access article.
Yeah, let's see, if not,
you'll have to edit all of this out.
Well, right. we'll figure something. Or we'll get a massive Twitter following, and then we can explain it away that way. The second thing was, so the first thing I was thinking of that past article, and yes, so we'll post it on musictherapyresearchblog.com along with the podcast. But the second part of that, for me, is thinking about... I'm complaining a little bit about GarageBand, but really think about how much even our journals have changed. I get to look right now at my massive collection of journals of music therapy. I even collected a bunch from people that were getting rid of them. So I've got the JMTs going back to the 70s and 80s on one side of the aisle, and then I've got my one, and so I've got I've got my block of brown, and then I got the one blue JMT sitting at the end, and I've got the second one just sitting over on my desk so I can read it a little bit. But so it's not just the cover, but it is that relationship with Oxford University Press, and that seems like maybe that's just a publishing deal, but it's really not. It's really the idea that we're affiliated with this new press organization, especially one as esteemed as Oxford University, is a big deal for AMTA, not because we get a fancy cover, which is nice, but it's because of that online access, and we're reviewers. We're on the editorial board for JMT now, and so even the process for us getting papers in and then being able to review them and getting them back out, that's something that Dr. Raab and then also Dr. Tony Meadows for Perspectives is really accelerating for us.
Mm-hmm. I think that the remake of the journals is really exciting, and the online piece is so important because even here, you know, we have a music therapy program at a major university, and we would have to do these request forms to get copies of articles. Even the JMT, you could go and get it from the library, but if you wanted a PDF, you'd have to go through this entire long process to get the article. And now it's just so easy with the AMTA membership to go on and look at all the different research articles. And what I like about it is they have this little column of like what's popular and what's being most cited. And so it kind of gives you an idea of what's trending in the field as well as far as research goes.
People could, from hanging around me at, let's say, conferences or working with me for a certain period of time, they could see me as a complainer. They could see me as like,
no.
Oh, he's that guy that goes on those rants about 80s music whenever AMTA conference rolls around and we end up in a Hard Rock Cafe near a conference environment. So yes, it's possible that I could be seen as a complainer. But I don't want to, I also want to note that wouldn't it be interesting to see how long dissertations and theses took in the 70s, 80s, 90s of the advent of the internet, and that, you know, just somebody starting and, you know, getting their, you know, whatever it might be called, their proposal agreed to by a committee and everything, wouldn't all this stuff naturally make those timelines go down? I mean, gone are the times when word processors are going to break down on you. Probably gone are the times, and I did know a couple people when I was doing my dissertation. I knew a couple people in my cohort that still would lug around boxes that had all their files because they demanded to print out every single one of their reference articles or something. But really, if you're going to put together a thesis or a dissertation now, the idea that this, especially if you're still hooked up with that university, it seems like this is something that should really accelerate research and make it more, I don't know what you'd call it, timely or prescient.
Yeah, I think absolutely, especially if you think about how at one point in time people were having to type their entire dissertation, and should there be a mistake, you have, like now it's hard enough to go back and have to make those changes, but can you imagine doing that on a typewriter or so forth? My father tells me stories about that when he did his thesis, that it was typed and that was a really difficult process. But on the other hand, something that I think we need to always honor is that research is a process, and it's a huge learning process. So when you're looking at thesis projects, dissertations, and then eventually, you know, the beginning researcher, there's this huge trajectory of learning that has to happen until you're feeling really confident as a researcher. And, you know, even myself beginning and still feeling like, what do I do? There's so many ideas. How do I funnel it down? How do I decide on a research line? And then trying to build and develop those skills while building and developing the research base for the profession, it's a hard process that takes time, and you're always learning.
Have you changed your Twitter bio yet?
I think my Twitter bio still says new excited, researcher, excited new researcher, which
it?
I still feel like, you know.
That's good. That's Michelle Erfurt. She's the, she changed from the music therapy tween to moving on to like the resources and things she's putting out.
I think I'll consider myself an excited new researcher until I land that really big first grant.
The one big external grant.
Right, which to me is like the
tenure
goal.
Tenure and promotion has happened.
Yeah.
And yet, excited
got tenure,
new researcher.
Still excited new researcher, hoping for that 100K grant minimum at some point in time. Minimum. If you're going to go big, right? And 100K in research is surprisingly not that much money.
Surprisingly, especially, yeah.
100K, like additional salary, a lot of money.
Yeah, right.
100K
yes.
Research, not a lot of money. It goes so quick.
Yeah. So in the time that it would take us to bike from here, the University Center for the Arts, in about a 5-minute bike ride, we can be surrounded by a bunch of our colleagues who have to be pulling in 7-figure grants, you know. So the idea that we can be in social sciences or even sneak out some humanities grants or something, but being able to really collaborate somehow with some more excited new researchers, whether it's on their Twitter bios or not, is something that's really exciting for me too, especially being on a new campus, because I had my collaborations when I was at University of North Dakota, and now I get to forge a whole bunch of new ones here.
Mm-hmm.
But holy smokes, are there a whole bunch of new opportunities, and it's a matter of sort of sifting through really quick and then seeing who are the people that you can meet with and really click with and that they want to work with you and that they're as excited about music therapy specifically as I am.
And I hope that that's how it is at a lot of universities, that there's just this excitement and this buzz around research, not only universities, hospitals, and so forth. I feel like with the blog, I get emails on a monthly basis of people interested in doing research and asking how they get started. And that's another thing that I hope that we can do with the podcast is interviewing people or bringing our own ideas in about how to get started, how to do research that's meaningful yet feasible within your current clinical or environment, research environment that you might have around you, so that we can bring more research to the field, but that it's quality, that it's worthwhile, and that it's publishable in the end.
And we'll be talking about how we're going to do that from musictherapyresearchblog.com and then, you know, through social media as well. But if you didn't hear some of the first couple podcasts of, I guess, you know, now that I think about it, I think like our sixth or seventh podcast was actually at the International Conference for Music Perception and Cognition in Seattle. We did that. So our, you know, pretty early on, we did a remote and we were gathering just researchers at poster sessions, I remember, and talking to some other music therapists, but also non-music therapists as well. So I'm guessing now that I suppose we're technically maybe about 4 years old or so. Those first other podcasts, we talked just like about those topics that you mentioned. I think some of the other areas for us to revisit now that it's been a couple of years, like you said, are maybe the methodological orientations. That's something else that came out, I'm thinking 2011, 2012, Journal of Music Therapy, and you did the pilot
and feasibility. And that's been a great ongoing series where they're featured articles, and there's one on randomized controlled trial, there's one on mixed method design, there's one on grounded theory, and it's just a fantastic series of articles, and I believe there's more coming out in that series, looking at different designs as well.
One of the other things that, as we mentioned, we'll focus on is we'll have some local people involved here with the podcast, but also keep on looking for people who maybe we can't visit, or if we can go to a conference and bring a smaller bunch of gear, then we can talk with people who are at poster sessions, people that want to talk to us, and they say, hey, I've been listening to the podcast, I'm wondering if you'd address this is an area that I'm really interested in talking about, to bring that really different group of minds onto the podcast and see if that's helpful for you. We also want to make sure that it's useful for not just students of ours, but anybody that's interested in talking to us about some of our research ideas. So we'll also talk about some of the research that we're doing. You've been in continuous work here at CSU, so you've got studies that have been going on for a couple of years now. You've got other studies that you're starting on that are probably going to go for a couple of years. Is there anything in particular that you want to dive into or that you can preview at this point?
The studies I'm most excited about are studies I'm doing on children who are on the autism spectrum. And what's really exciting to me is we just got a small grant to do a study where our pre and post tests are neurophysiological measures, which happen to be EEG in this case. So with the electroencephalogram, we're going to be able to measure patterns in the brain, and then we'll be doing that before and after a very specific music therapy protocol with a very specific idea in mind of what we hope to change in the brain, which I can't give away too many details, but I'm so stinking excited. It's not mind control. No, not at all.
Okay,
not at all.
Once, if it's mind control.
No. I'm really excited. Not only because this is going to be one of the first studies really using those neurophysiological measures as pre and post test, but also because it's a collaborative project between myself and other researchers across campus. And those collaborations are the ones that really excite me. Doing research alone feels like you're on your own. You're just you feel it's very lonely. Research is a very lonely place at times.
You're flashing back to your dissertation right now.
In other projects that I've done. And so whenever there's a collaboration, I find that the research moves a lot faster because you're accountable to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And also the ideas that are spurred from that and the learning that happens from that is just really, really valuable.
So it's the trade-off that some people maybe aren't, you know, some people recognize that, well, it's going to take extra time. There's going to be that many more emails back and forth with my collaborators. And I was just on a paper that's submitted now, but it's with a bunch of people at some other universities, just a process piece. It wasn't even an experimental piece. We had picked up the data and everything, but even just getting us all together for a conference call. I mean, you start off with just the basic logistics of it, and you do a project like that, and I was ready to dig into something on my own. I'm like, I think I just want to write by myself for a while.
Yeah.
I think I can pump something out here. And then you'll get sick of that. And I feel like maybe I'm just going back and forth between those two poles of collaboration versus just by myself or with one of the co-authors.
And I think there's a little bit of a difference there between local collaboration, where I can walk to the office of the person I'm collaborating with and talk to them, versus that distance collaboration. And as we all know, you know, sitting on a lot of committees for instance, AMTA, getting any 4 to 5 people together at any one point in time is completely difficult. So I think the local collaborations right now are really exciting me, especially with other professionals and other professionals who see value in what we do. And so they're putting this research on their schedule, which is really exciting because it's not even in their field. So
is this the best period of time in our profession, or let's say even since NAMT was founded, or let's say since 1964, since the Journal of Music Therapy started up? Is this the best, most robust time for research in music therapy? Are we in it? Are we accelerating or moving in the right direction?
I think we're moving in the right direction, but I hope that there's more to come, especially with the number of people who can do research in our field. When you look through the journal, you're seeing a lot of repeat names, the Silvermans that are publishing a lot.
I trademarked the term pulling a Silverman. If you pull a Silverman, you're published in both Music Therapy Perspectives and Journal of Music Therapy at the same time.
Which I believe I've done once.
You're in the pulling.
I'm in the club.
Yeah.
So I'll have to tell
Dr. S on the board.
Dr. And then, Silverman that.
And then you'll be on it, and I can't think. I think there's one other person. Maybe Bill. Maybe Bill Matt. Maybe he pulled a Silverman. I don't remember now.
But when we have more people who are doing that research, and not only doing their own track of research, but people in the same area doing similar yet different research, that's really exciting because it makes what we have more robust, that it's not just one person showing that something seems to work. It's multiple clinics and multiple sites showing that music in therapy can really create change for individuals and improve their outcomes in their lives. And I find that really exciting.
I think the other part about growth in research is not just what we measure in the journals, and not the way that we, speaking of Dr. Silverman, but for instance, he's got an article, I think, with Amy Furman, our AMTA president now, on sort of like an analysis of Journal of Music Therapy articles. And we can see what's actually happening in journals. It's a matter of counting to some extent. But what else is interesting is, so something I set up and I talked to our students about, setting a Google Alert up so that every time you see music therapy in the news, it pops up in Google Alerts, and then Google sends you an email anytime you want them to. So Friday mornings, I know that I can get into the office here and I can see, and I would say maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I would see a lot of music therapy articles that were not music therapy, that were ones that I'd immediately think, well, that's probably something for the Professional Advocacy Committee to attack, or should AMTA know about this? Or it was something that was sort of way off the beaten path, or it was especially from other countries as well. And I think whether it's the idea of music therapy as the concept spreading to a lot more countries, so becoming more worldwide, or the World Federation for Music Therapy becoming more more present, I guess, for lack of a better word, or whether it is really specifically that those stories are getting pushed out because there's more stories that are dominated by research. So it is really neat for me to be able to click on stories and see colleagues that we know. And the local news did an interesting story, not just because, well, that's cute, we saw music happening at the Children's Hospital, or it seems like music is really helping this older adult with Parkinson's to sing better. A touching piece like that that's really important. Or like the new documentary called Alive Inside that, you know, that's getting a lot of press now because it's, and we knew about it. And if you haven't seen it yet, AMTA has a response video with Dr. Alicia Clare that says, we're in favor of more music, but also let's be very wary of the idea of just going around slapping headphones and iPods on older adults with dementia. So it's neat that stories are coming out because they're based on research. So our colleagues are doing research. That's coming out in a journal. University, let's say, sends out a press release, and the press really wants to eat that up and say, wow, not only is it a cool piece because you get to watch the music therapy happening, but it's also because they can report that this new research article says music is powerful in ways X, Y, and Z as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I guess I wonder, as we move forward here, we've got AMTA conference that's coming up a little bit earlier this year, so that's early November.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of our agenda for the podcast, we'll get this out when we get on our regular schedule for podcasting now that we're set up here. So we've got the AMTA conference. Are there any other sort of big research events that are on your radar or at least for the rest of this calendar year or for the academic year?
Not any out that I'm going to right now. I have a lot of deadlines with grant writing and just my own personal projects.
Are the grant writing projects for a private jet so you can go to our conferences? Why can't we do that?
As I said before, I'll settle for 100K. So private jet seems a little bit like farther out there.
Can we not get a small, just like a two-seater for 100K?
So no, I don't
feel
believe
like
that,
that
would
you really,
can.
I feel like
you could get a nice Tesla though. So
a Tesla. So as long as we've got somebody in Denver or Cheyenne that we can drive to quickly and without any gas.
Correct.
Can Teslas get up to 75 miles an hour on I-25?
Actually, yes. They're very powerful.
They can? They are?
But this podcast is not. I actually had the opportunity to ride in a Tesla.
You did.
And I was very impressed.
Oh, well,
and I thought, wow, maybe someday.
And you thought. And,
and then
right.
I looked up how much it cost.
Well, no. But then your mind, because it immediately, you thought research grant, right?
No.
You sent me the tweet on the Apple Watch, and you're like, I think I don't even wear watches, but I think I'd like this. And I looked at it, and I saw everyone else talking about it, and I said, research grant? I don't know. Could it be a timing mechanism where it automatically
cues you to
do some singing exercises, or it'll automatically start tapping a beat for you to walk to?
More so than the Tesla, I think that watch, you're actually onto something there, and something we've been working on here is trying to use iPods as a way to collect cheap data, because equipment costs so much to invest in. And so if we can find ways that are quality to take data, then we're kind of a leg up on research. So that's one of the other things we've been doing, or I've been working on with the team.
That's another area of interest of mine, too, as a matter of fact. One of the things that has come up pretty recently and something that I'm digging through right now is Wendy McGee's new book. Wendy McGee from now Temple University, but was working at, I think it's the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability in London, or in the UK, and Music Technology and Therapeutic and Health Settings, a really nice book. And then I've been writing a couple of technology articles, and you wrote the first one with me that's in Music Therapy Perspectives as sort of an editor's wish that Dr. Tony Meadows has added. And one of those weird things about technology is, yes, I do want to see how technology can tie into research better, because clinically, one of the points that we made both in one of the articles, I can't remember which one, at a conference presentation, like a panel presentation, was that it's very clear that technology is being used clinically in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very clear, and Dr. McGee said this in her portion of that conference presentation, and says as much in the introduction of the textbook, that's Jessica Kingsley Publishers, I think, if you haven't picked it up. Yes, it is. That we also don't have very much research on how well we're using the technology. At the same time, it's very clear that there is research coming out, but even when we're writing up methodologies, it's not quite clear. You can say that I used an iPod to get this bit of data, or I used a Fitbit, you know, in physical therapy literature is talking about those electronic monitoring bracelets and everything now. But we don't always know if there's a good set of guidelines in terms of how we were using the technology, or at least how we reported in the literature.
Right. I think something that you just mentioned that's important, though, is many other fields are already using this technology in
Absolutely.
Research and in their clinical application. And I almost feel like we need to get there ourselves. And I think perhaps we were using technology sooner in many applications with music technology. It's just making that application to research that's functional and useful for the client.
It's a good point. We have a lot more information that we want to share with you on future podcasts. We'll leave it there for now, and we'll see you back here for the next installment of The Reboot. How about we call it that?
The Reboot.
Or Reprise.
Podcast 2.0.
Reprise? Coda? I don't know.
I'm going to stick with 2.0.
All right. Sounds good. And that'll be on the research, podcast for the Music Therapy Research blog.
Today's music is While She Sleeps by The Lights Galaxia. This has been the Music Therapy Research Podcast associated with musictherapyresearchblog.com. Your hosts are Dr. Blythe Lagasse and Dr. Andrew Knight, music therapy faculty members at Colorado State University. Follow MTRB on Facebook and your hosts on Twitter to stay up on all the music therapy research we send out into the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please let us know by heading to iTunes and submitting a review and a rating. It only takes a minute and helps our visibility on the iTunes page tremendously. Thanks in advance. Also, send in a comment about the podcast on the contact page at musictherapyresearchblog.com.